Chapter 4, Rebirth of the Two-State Solution. Well, Hisham, 1967 came and changed everything, but in the years just before 1967, where did the idea of the two-state solution stand as far as the Palestinian community?
Well, let's remember, Mark, that as the PLO was established in 1964, and mainly as Fatah was launched in 1965, in Palestinian thinking, what was really suggested was the establishment of one state in Palestine, a secular democratic state for all, regardless of religion, etc. In other words, in Palestinian thinking, there was really no room, no mention of a two-state solution. And when the 67 war took place, when Israel occupied all of Palestine, in addition to Arab territories such as the Sinai Peninsula and the Golan Heights, in Palestinian thinking, this confirmed need the urgency for the one-state solution, not the two-state solution. And that remained to be the case for until the mid-1970s. In other words, during the first stage, the building stage, the PLO and its main organizations were intent only on the establishment of a one state in Palestine. Zionism was completely rejected. Israel was considered to be an extension of colonialism. And the idea of partition was also rejected by Palestinians. The Resolution 242 by the United Nations Security Council, which was passed in November 1967 after the war, was also rejected by Palestinians. It was considered as a resolution that views the question of Palestine only as a question of refugees, and that it recognizes Israel, and that acceptable for Palestinians. And for a few years, Palestinians were consumed, if you will, were preoccupied with the attempt to solidify their own position, to keep the PLO on its feet. There were some high points and there were some low points. One of the high points was in 1968 on March 21st, Moshe Dayan, the Israeli defense minister, launched a concerted attack at one of the bases for the Fidaeen, that is the Palestinian commandos, in Jordan, in a town called Al-Karama. Dayan believed, actually he said, that he plans to have breakfast in Amman, dinner, lunch in Damascus, and dinner in Cairo, i.e. suggesting that he is going to crush the PLO, crush the commandos completely, and sweep through all those Arab countries. Well, Dayan was shocked and surprised. A few, handful of Palestinian freedom fighters managed to withstand the Israeli attack to defeat the Israeli army during that battle. And that, in a way, acquired Fatah, the leading organization at that time, so much fame, so much reputation, and so much support. In the process, strengthening its conviction that there ought to be in Palestine only one state. But following the victory in Karama, the PLO was dealt a very big blow, as many know, in Jordan in 1970 during the Black September war, as it was called. Many Palestinians, many PLO commandos were killed. Statistics vary, but the most modest suggests that at least 30,000 Palestinians were killed. And it was a gruesome event, Mark. I happened to be in Amman during that period by sheer coincidence. I was a little child, and we saw the beginnings of the September war on the Palestinians, and we escaped. We returned back to Palestine, really under the cover of very heavy exchanges of fire. Amman during daylight, even around noon, was so dark because of the extensive exchange of fire. So these were some of the issues that the PLO was preoccupied
with. Well, Hisham, had the PLO won what was essentially a civil war, the Hashemites remained in control of the East Bank and of the West Bank at the time. You were born in Jordan, even though it was the West Bank of Palestine. What would have happened at that point? Would the Palestinian issue have, would Palestinian control have taken place in Amman? And there would have been a whole different dynamic.
Yeah, of course. Had the Palestinians won that war, the outcome would have been absolutely different. Yes, indeed. Officially speaking, I was born, in the West Bank, which was under Jordanian control. So actually, my official, birth certificate, other official paperwork indicate that I was born in the West Bank of Jordan. In other words, there was a total negation of, Palestinian territory, Palestinian identity. I was born in 1963. Had the Palestinians won the 1970 war in Jordan, of course things would have been different. Although I happen to believe that the PLO was really trapped into that war in Jordan. I don't think Arafat wanted that war in any way whatsoever. The victory of Karama, I think, not only angered the Israelis, but it also frustrated King Hussein of Jordan. He became concerned that those freedom fighters, those PLO fighters who managed to really defeat the Israelis could pose a serious danger to him. And therefore, some elements of the Jordanian intelligence community began to infiltrate some PLO groups and behave obnoxiously in order to project an image that the PLO itself, that PLO commanders were acting in a harmful way against the Jordanians, in a provocative way against Jordanian officers and soldiers, in order to make the PLO really look bad. And of course, in 1970, there were some hijacked planes by the PFLP, the Palestine Liberation Front for Palestine, which were landed in Amman, in Jordan, and I think that was the straw that broke the back of the camel for the king.
Well, fair enough.
Not the only event.
But we've gotten ahead of ourselves. Let's go back to the 67 war, because that's where the territories were taken by the Israelis. That's where Jerusalem, the West Bank, Gaza, and Sinai all were taken over by Israel. And did that, must have had a tremendous impact on Palestinian thinking, and of course the resurrection of the two-state solution then started to take place with UN resolutions and with some Israelis thinking, well, what are we going to do with these territories? There were Israelis at the time who thought they should be the godfather of the Palestinian state, and maybe that would make the Palestinians think better of them. But you were there, you were a little boy at the time, but so with the 67 war, how did this impact thinking about a two-state solution, or how did it impact Palestinian thinking in general?
Well, Palestinians were in a state of another shock. Here's another war. Here was a theatrical war, really, because, yes, in official documents it says that it lasted for 6 days, but in Palestinian thinking, Palestinian observed the war it lasted for 6 hours. The territory was occupied very quickly. The Egyptian air fleet was destroyed on the ground during the first hour of the war. The Sinai Peninsula was penetrated so sweepingly, so was the Golan Heights. The West Bank fell, you know, quicker than one can even recount. So it was a big shock for Palestinians. Secondly, there was another round of refugees. Hundreds of thousands of Palestinians found themselves evicted of their country, not for the first time, for the second time, including my own family. We ended up in a brutal, brutal refugee camp in the desert in Jordan called Wad Vlail. And in my entire life, I never remember any more wicked environment that we lived in than that environment. Fortunately, we were one of the lucky Palestinian families that managed to come back to Palestine, quote-unquote, illegally during 67 until the borders became tighter and nobody could return. So in Palestinian thinking, you know, Palestinians were really preoccupied with their attempt to absorb the shock, with their evaluation of the Arab state system as bankrupt, as defeatist, including that of Nasser. I mean, Nasser was beloved by all Arabs, but he was defeated in 67. However, politically speaking, yes, the 67 war, I think, planted the first seeds afresh for the two-state solution. Following the 67 war, subsequently, Arab countries and then subsequently Palestinians started talking about the need for withdrawal from the 67 occupied territory, that is, return to the pre-June 6, 1967 borders. And so the 67 war became really the cutoff point, I believe, for any solution in Palestinian thinking, in Arab thinking, but that didn't happen until several years later, about a decade later.
Well, what did happen, was the UN passed a resolution that we're still talking about today, Resolution 242. What was the Palestinian and the PLO reaction to that?
Total refusal, absolutely. The belief, as I said earlier, that Resolution 242 viewed the Palestinian problem only as a problem of refugees, that it called for the recognition of Israel, and that it did not really recognize the right of Palestinians to self-determination and to return. So the 242 was initially completely rejected by Palestinians until several years later, when the PLO modified its position, introduced a number of compromises, including its acceptance of resolutions 242 and consequently of Security Council Resolution 338, which was passed after the 1973 war.
Well, not only did the PLO reject 242, but the Arab League, I believe, met in Khartoum later in 67 and became famous for the three no's. I'm trying to remember, no negotiations, no recognition, and what was the third no? We'll have to look it up.
No negotiations, right, no recognition, no acceptance of 242. I believe.
Uh-huh. All right. So between the years 67 and 73, between the two big wars, I guess the PLO was just building up its legitimacy, building up its credibility, and organizing Palestinians for resistance. Is that what was happening?
Absolutely. Definitely. The PLO was really trying to stand on its feet, to stand the blow of 1970, from Jordanian regime. The PLO after 1970 was moved to Lebanon, and that's where it established its headquarters. So when the 73 war was fought, it boosted the morale of the Arabs. It boosted the morale of the PLO. The PLO participated in the war on the Egyptian front, on the Syrian front. It had a role to play, and therefore the Palestinian element was reincorporated into, you know, the broader context of Arab politics. The PLO was back on its feet. It managed to really meet the challenges. It acquired the support of the Palestinians themselves. The Palestinians viewed the PLO as their sole legitimate representative. But the 73 war was another landmark event, for the Arabs were not defeated. Yes, they were not victorious. They did not achieve any territorial gains, but at least compared to 48 and to 67, they were not defeated. They were not crushed. So that enabled Sadat afterwards to enter into negotiations with Israel, as we might discuss later on. But it also enabled the PLO to begin introducing some compromises for the solution. And I can think of three main compromises that were introduced in 1974. Before that, I should hasten and add that when the Geneva conference was held in December 1973, of course, the PLO was not a party to it. Neither the United States nor Israel accepted to have the PLO to be a participant. But in 1974, number one, in June 1974, the PLO passed in the 12th Palestine National Council session held in Cairo what came to be known as the 10-point program. Now, the 10-point program, yes, re-emphasized the right of the PLO to armed struggle, to the totality of Palestine, etc., etc., but it said that the PLO was ready to establish a Palestinian national authority on any part that would be liberated from Palestine, signifying its willingness to accept the existence of more than one state in Palestine at a given moment. In other words, the 10-point program has been interpreted by many observers as the beginning of a cycle of compromises that the PLO introduced. Subsequently, in 1974, the PLO managed to acquire from the Arab state system recognition that it is, i.e. the PLO, the sole legitimate representative of the Palestinian people. What was important about that was that Jordan, you know, King Hussein of Jordan, who participated in that Arab summit held in Rabat, Morocco, also recognized the PLO as the sole legitimate representative of the Palestinian people. But certainly, the Arab state system would not have done that without signals from the PLO that it is willing to settle for something less than the totality of Palestine. Also, in 1974, Arafat went to the United Nations and had a historic address to the UN General Assembly, in which he unequivocally said that he is willing to enter into a peaceful solution for the Palestinian problem. In other words, that he does not necessarily say that the only way for a solution was the armed struggle, as was emphatically said before that point. He said, you know, don't let the olive branch fall from my hand. In other words, that I'm coming to you with a message of peace and I'm willing to, to enter into a peaceful solution. Now, these were very, very important, developments.
Yes, Hisham.
In my view, making it possible for the two-state solution to be resurrected.
I was in New York at the time. I was going to graduate school at the Wilson Center, the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton, but I was the UN representative for the International Student Movement for the United Nations, ISMN. And I remember what a day that was. I remember the unbelievable security, the unbelievable lockdown around the UN. At the time, the Israelis and the Americans considered the PLO a terrorist organization, refused to have any dealings with it. But nevertheless, here was Arafat representing it, addressing the United Nations. And it certainly had an impact on all of us at the time. But other things were happening, too. Right after the 73 war, that's when Kissinger stepped in with his step-by-step diplomacy. The war itself had what was called the nuclear alert, where there was a worry it was possible the U.S. and the Soviet Union could make a mistake and end up in a nuclear conflict. And the Israelis had nuclear weapons, which they've denied then and still deny. But I remember the stories about how Dayan, who you mentioned, worried that they could even possibly lose the 73 war, had ordered the tactical nuclear weapons to be made ready. And that really panicked Nixon and Kissinger. And so then the war ended. The step-by-step diplomacy was underway. The PLO and the Palestinians were taking the steps you said. There was talk of a Geneva conference, which the Soviet Union and the United States would co-chair. I think it convened once and then recessed and never did convene again. And then there was the reassessment. I was just getting involved in those years, and I remember, what's going on? There's a reassessment of U.S. relations with the Middle East, and under the table, it was a reassessment of U.S. relations with Israel. Now, I don't know how much of that was theatrical. I don't know how much of that was to get the Geneva conference going. But from the Palestinian point of view, it sounds like there were subtle little hints being thrown out that were maybe too subtle for most of us to pick up at the time. But you Palestinians apparently were picking them up.
Well, I mean, certainly. I mean, that was a period, in my view, that some trends in the PLO were getting stronger and stronger. Those that were convinced of reconciliation of the conflict, that is, a resolution for the conflict through peaceful means, through negotiations. But such trends, of course, took some time to really develop, to acquire acceptance in the PLO itself, because the operative ideology was one of armed struggle and one of a secular democratic state. But I think the more the PLO hinted at compromises and at its willingness to settle for a two-state solution, the more adamant Israel became to try to crush the PLO. In other words, look at the very strange correlation between the rise of the popularity of that trend in the PLO after 1975, all throughout the 1970s, on the one hand, and the increase in Israel's determination to crush the PLO in Lebanon. Look at how many wars. How many battles Israel has, led or waged in Lebanon against the PLO. Of course, the PLO had to withstand all of that and also to withstand, the Lebanese Civil War in 1975 and its involvement in that war. So there were so many challenges, but nonetheless, the PLO kept making such chance at a peaceful resolution and at its willingness to enter into a, negotiated settlement for the conflict, which took several years, I think, to mature and to become the, now it's the operative only strategy for the PLO at this stage in 2011.
Well, but what happened back in those years, there was the expectation that Ford and Kissinger would continue, but that didn't happen. Jimmy Carter won the presidency, and that changed the dynamics. And then Anwar Sadat made the changes he made. But that's really the subject for Chapter 5, what happened when Jimmy Carter became president. There was talk of a Palestinian homeland. They didn't even use the term Palestinian state in those days. And then Sadat came along, and as you know, I played a role, having met with him personally. He made his trip to Israel, and then all kinds of diplomatic things took place. But that's the subject for the next chapter.